Hello, I'm Emily Webb. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is Outlook. Every day we bring you incredible personal stories, and today we're giving you an insight into the life of a musical great as we meet the virtuoso trumpeter, composer, and band leader, Wynton Marsalis. He's been described as America's national treasure. He's as comfortable playing Haydn's Concerto in D major as he is leading a quintet in the Tiger Rag. He's toured with top musicians and sold millions of records worldwide. He's hosted jazz clinics on Sesame Street as well as in the White House. He's also made history by becoming the first ever jazz musician to win a Pulitzer Prize for his epic orchestral work, Blood on the Fields. When I read that in front of me, it does make me think, what have I done with my life? Do you ever take a break?
No, I mean, I'm lucky to do what I always wanted to do. This is my hobby as well as a profession, and it's been a blessing for me. So I have energy for it. I love doing it so much that I don't really get tired, and I never really want to take a break. It is a break.
So when you switch off at the end of the day, you basically just play more jazz, listen to more jazz?
Jazz, classical music, tango, flamenco music.
But this isn't just a story of Wynton Marsalis's many musical accomplishments. It's also about the relationship between a father and son and a musical education that started in the bars of New Orleans, went around the world, then back home again. Wynton Marsalis once said that jazz is about joy. So if you're a jazz lover, you're in for a very joyful 40 minutes. Non-jazz lovers, don't be deterred, because the hope is this programme might just convert you. Wynton was born in 1961 in New Orleans, the fabled birthplace of jazz itself. He was immersed in music from the get-go. His father, Ellis, was a pianist with a band, and from around the age of four, Wynton would go along to the gigs and concerts.
The gigs I always went on, they were in like bars, real country, segregated environment. I was always the only kid there. Somebody would be drunk and somebody would be belligerent and something would be always going on, but there was always like a lady behind the bar that was giving me a shrimp sandwich or something, always because it's a little kid, not supposed to be in the bar really because I was with my daddy, they would let me hang.
And as Wynton got a bit older and began to tune in, he realised how accomplished a musician his dad, Ellis, was.
I remember once he had another band director named John Fernandez, we call him Johnny. He had three daughters and we had four sons. The oldest three daughters was roughly the age of me and my older brother Branford and my little brother Ellis. So we would all have crushes on his daughters. And we were at the concert one night, and I might have been 9 or 10, and their bass player didn't show up. And Johnny got on the microphone and said, "We're going to have Ellis Marsalis come up and play bass." I didn't know my daddy could play bass. And he went up on the bandstand and started playing bass. And then he played saxophone. So he could play bass, could play saxophone, could play clarinet, and could play piano.
Wow. A true musician.
Yeah.
Surrounded by all this jazz music, you'd think that Wynton would be a fan. But in fact, as a boy, he actively disliked it. He was into funk, electronic music. Jazz, in his eyes, was old-fashioned. And growing up in New Orleans, there was no escaping the shadow of the city's greatest musical master, perhaps the most influential jazz musician that ever lived.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on.
The trumpet player Louis Armstrong.
Imagination will thrive upon that kiss.
But young Wynton, still not a fan.
I didn't really know Louis Armstrong's music the way I should have known it, because I was coming in the civil rights movement, and at that time, younger people looked at older black musicians who were smiling or doing the different things they would do. Yes, boss and all that. So we looked at Louis Armstrong through that lens.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take you all the way down to New Orleans this time, my good old hometown. Look out there, son. Let's go. One.
we looked down on that. So it kept me from really understanding the depth of Louis Armstrong's genius at that time. I was more ashamed of him out of ignorance and misunderstanding. So I didn't really embrace him like I should have, especially because I had a father who knew who he was and was always telling me, check out Pops, whereas none of my friends really had any idea who Louis Armstrong was.
Ellis, however, wasn't put off by his son's complete lack of interest and decided it was time to start his musical training. So he bought Wynton his first instrument.
And he got me a trumpet, but I didn't really practice the trumpet, or I wasn't serious about it, and I couldn't play because I didn't really know the music.
And the reason you didn't practice, I've heard, is because you were worried about how it would make your face look.
Yeah, I didn't want my lips. The trumpet players in New Orleans had them ugly lips. So it'd be red and swollen. And I was like, man, I do not want my lips looking like that. The girl's not going to like me. So in my young years, you know, I played in different little bands and stuff, but I wasn't really serious about playing.
Wynton wasn't serious about playing, but growing up in New Orleans, it was pretty hard to escape jazz.
When I was 8, I had played in a band called the Fairview Baptist Church Marching Band. So we played New Orleans music, songs like Little Liza Jane, Didn't He Ramble, New Orleans Second Line, in the Sweet By and By. And we would play parades and we would play in the street.
Street parades and even funeral processions. New Orleans is famous for it.
There were still enough older musicians playing. The older ones were very dignified. You know, the older musicians had their black and whites on. And if it's a funeral, they start off playing the dirge, the drums play a slow song on the way out to the burial site. And then after we leave, we play fast. And when we play fast, we go to all the different places that the deceased would go to. We stop in bars and restaurants. Sometimes we carry the casket with us, and sometimes they open the casket and give them the last drink. But it would be just very lively. And because it was our way of life, we didn't really look at it any kind of way. You know, we didn't look at it like this is our heritage.
You grew up with 5 other siblings, all brothers, and most of them played music as well. Can you paint a picture of what your house looked like and sounded like at that time?
Well, it was pandemonium. There was a lot of people in a small space. We had struggles. There was a lot of noise. It wasn't a lot of sitting around in an orderly fashion. It wasn't the Von Trapp family on the movie, you know. It wasn't like we sitting around having deep conversations about jazz. And there was a lot of strife and problems. You know, my mom and daddy were going through a lot. It was a rough time. My mother never knew her father. And she struggled with that. My father's father had grown up in a sharecropping family in Mississippi, had come to New Orleans. I mean, their struggles to come down generations. I mean, they were living out their lives in the context of that experience. And my daddy, being a jazz musician, he was always struggling with money. The people we were living around and the general public, me included, we didn't really like that kind of music. So I always was the feeling they were going uphill against a popular trend and a culture and taste that were not shaped to their music and were not going to come around to it. He would play concerts and gigs. There were never a lot of people there, and it was really a struggle.
Tell me about one gig that you went to when there wasn't really anybody there.
Yeah, he used to play at a club called Lou and Charlie's on Rampart Street. I was the treasurer for their band, so I write out checks for people and keep the books. So I knew how little money they were making. But he had an arrangement with Charlie where he would close the club because he'd been playing there so long and everything was familiar. And the gig normally ended at 2:30. So one night, one person was in the club drunk. And I told my daddy, man, let's go, man. Keep in mind, I've been in clubs with him since 1964, 65. So since I was 3 or 4 years old, now I'm 13 or 14. I'm wondering, man, why does this guy keep playing this kind of music? Nobody want to hear it. Let's go, man. And he looked at me and said, man, you know, why don't you sit your ass down and listen to some music for a change? He didn't normally talk to me like that. So it made me laugh. It kind of shocked me. So I sat down and I just looked around the club. I wonder what makes somebody play like how he's playing for me. And I don't even want to hear it. And then at 2:30, when the gig was supposed to be over, he stopped. They always stays in my mind. That experience stays in my mind. The way he was playing and the fact that he played with that type of feeling and intensity for nobody but me.
Ellis Marsalis was jazz royalty in New Orleans. His reputation was such that when Wynton was 12 and joined a new school, the band director was thrilled. Ellis Marsalis' son was going to be trying out for his school band. Expectations were sky high, but...
Yeah, I was so sad at my audition when I was 12 years old. Our band director was a guy named George Marks. He was a trumpet player. When he knew that me and my brother were coming, and man, we got Ellis Marsalis' son's coming. And after I played my audition, he looked at me and said, "Are you sure you're Ellis's son?"
Wow. It's pretty brutal.
I was so sad he couldn't believe it. Oh, man.
So what changed then when you were 12?
Well, I went into school. I had like a scholarship to play basketball. I was going to be on the basketball team. And then, I don't know, I was playing ball one day and I thought, man, I don't know that I want to do this as a man. And one night, me and my brother had our records on the ground and our father's records on the ground. You know, we're 12, 13. And we're looking at our records, and I asked Branford, I said, man, you notice how our records, people look stupid on them? You know, people coming out the mothership and all kind of crazy stuff going on. And on Daddy's records, they look intelligent. So we just looked at it. So I said, man, let's put this record on. So we put the records on. I started listening to it. And it's just John Coltrane. John Coltrane's record, Giant Steps. And I don't know why all the years I was with my father, I never really listened to the music. But Cousin Mary was my favorite one, just because of the cry in it. I'm not in the right key, but... I can still remember it. I just come home and put Train on and be like, damn. It's addictive when you start to hear it, because for years I couldn't really hear the music. And the music is a certain way. Like, you can go for a long time and you have no idea what it is. It doesn't speak to you. And then one day you hear something. It's almost like you crack a code or something to a language. And when that day comes and you can hear it, you can't believe what it is. And then I started to wonder if I could learn how to play like them, or, you know, actually be able to play instead of how we play. So I said, man, I can't just be one of the saddest trumpet players forever. I need to learn how to play. I was one of the worst trumpet players. So I started to take lessons and practice and become serious about it. So that happened for me when I was 12. I would practice in the morning, I would go to school, I practice at lunch, I come home, I practice for an hour, then I go to a rehearsal or a gig really almost every night.
Tell me about some of your first gigs. Where were they?
The first gig we ever played was at an elementary school called Our Lady of Perpetual Help. Everything was so segregated. We had met a white dude who played drums named George. So we said, hey, man, let's put a band together. It was me, my brother Branford. Our friend lived across the street from us named Theodore Lewis. But we called him Theto. And it was so novel to see black and white people doing anything together. So we had a big debate about where we were going to rehearse. We didn't want to go over on the white side of town. He didn't want to come over where black people were. But we got this gig playing at the elementary school. So we learned like 20 top 40 songs, that, you know, pop songs, whatever people were listening to and dancing to. So we played the dance, but the songs are only 3 minutes, so the dance was 2.5 hours or something. We finished playing the songs 45 minutes, 50 minutes into the gig. And then the nuns was like, okay, we got another hour, and we said, well, we're done. They said, oh, no, we got another hour and something to play. So we played those songs in a circle, over and over again for the next hour or something. That was our first gig. And then later I joined a funk band. Then I was just turned 13, called The Creators. And then we played a lot of jobs. We played like every kind of prom, dance, clubs, police talent shows where we played in the worst areas of New Orleans, outside of the worst housing projects the police department would put on shows. We're playing Parliament, Funkadelic, Earth, Wind & Fire, Marvin Gaye, the stuff that was on the radio. Once again, me and my brother, we were the two youngest on the whole scene.
Meanwhile, Ellis kept up his son's musical diet. Wynton still avoided Louis Armstrong, but stumbled across other genres.
First time I listened to classical music was Maurice André, great trumpet player. You know, my daddy would always say, check this out. Check this Disney record out about all the great composers when we were kids. And we went to a classical concert one time. There was no black people there. So we felt really out of place. But it was one black dude in the New Orleans orchestra. Because you got to remember at that time, consciousness was so black and white because of segregation, the civil rights movement. It was always a part of life you were living.
Inspired by the music, teenage Wynton joined the New Orleans Civic Orchestra. He was the only African-American there.
We were doing Beethoven's Fifth. And I remember I had never played a piece of classical music in the trumpet section. And I remember looking around in fascination, like, man, that bass is playing and boom, 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 just the whole piece. I said, man, I'm going to come back to this and do this. And plus, they had good basketball hoops in the Jewish Community Center. And it was maybe, I don't know, 20 blocks from my house on a streetcar line.
What do you think you learned from being part of that orchestra?
I think the main thing I learned was the love the people had of the music. And that orchestra played with a lot of love. And we played in parks and concerts. And I thought it was great to have the music be a part of the civic life of a city.
So obviously, all of this playing, you did improve dramatically. I mean, a long way from when you first tried out at the school band and he didn't believe that you were your father's son. And at 17, you got a scholarship to this very prestigious music school called Juilliard in New York. Arriving from New Orleans, how did you find it?
You know, New Orleans, we had one skyscraper at that time. And then they come into New York with all the skyscrapers and all the pace and the speed and the people. It was mind-boggling. I remember flying in thinking, man, what is this?
Because it was also around that time that you started learning more about the history of jazz. How did that happen?
Well, I was always around writers. Stanley Crouch is one writer that was like a mentor to me. Then the great Al Murray was an intellectual and a writer. He was living in Harlem on 132nd Street. Murray would just go from one thing to another thing. And he was always saying, get this book, get that book, pull this down off the shelf. Look at page 437, look at page such as that. And he was pulling from all kinds of things, from slave narratives to Greek mythology, to the writings of Isaac Newton. You never knew what he was going to come with. They were giving me more to study than I had gotten in any of my years in school.
So you're having this incredible education both inside and outside of Juilliard. It was also around the same time that your dad, after many, many years of trying, finally got you into Louis Armstrong. How did that happen?
Yeah, I was 17. I'd just come to New York. I was in a apartment. There's a lot of roaches in this apartment. I remember thinking, man, I got to get out of this apartment. And he sent me a tape. It was a cassette tape of Louis Armstrong.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights.
And I wasn't doing anything a weekend. I pulled the tape out. I said, let me learn a couple of these solos. I would always learn solos just from memory. I listened to them enough and play them. So I picked up a Louis Armstrong solo on Jubilee from the 1930s.
Jubilee, come and join the Jubilee. Gather on the run, sitting in the sun, have a little fun. Oh, Jubilee.
And I started trying to play it. and I couldn't play it all the way through. And I thought, man, it was interesting, his endurance, because it sounds easy because he's playing it. And when you try to play it, oof. And then I called my father. I said, man, it's Louis Armstrong. And I started trying to learn more of Pops's music and to understand who he was and come to grips with him as a historical figure and realize his significance. And that began that whole quest to learn his music.
But those early years in New York were also a bit of a struggle.
If you're from the South of America, you always think the North is less prejudiced, but it was actually more prejudiced in a way.
What sort of things happened?
You couldn't get cabs. The housing was really bad. Everything was segregated. Everybody lives in Harlem or Brooklyn. And for all the integration on the subway, there was no real integration of people. And because I was coming from the South, I was socially sensitive to it. Now, that had nothing to do with playing music in school, it was so hard to get in Juilliard. And of course, my friends and students, we didn't have that type of relationship because we were dealing with music. But of course, being in the situation we were in, there was always, you know, racism and conductors who would mess with you. I had a bad encounter with a conductor where this guy stops every time and berates my playing and stuff. Every time, first trumpet, we were playing the Rite of Spring in very high piccolo trumpet part. But I was playing and I thought, well, these notes are not as high as Earth, Wind & Fire's Africano medley that we used to play every night. And I was 14 or 13 then, so I could hit these high notes. I was playing the notes. He was the first trumpet. That's unmusical. First trumpet. So I went to the assistant dean. I said, man, I'm going to knock this dude out. You got to get. So the assistant dean looked at me and said, Marcellus, you from New Orleans? I said, yes, sir. He said, man, how's that gumbo down there? I said, good. And he just looked at me. His basic vibe was, son, what's wrong with you? You telling me you some kid from New Orleans, you got an upbringing in the street? What? You came up from New Orleans to be run out of a rehearsal by a conductor? And that was it. That was our meeting. So I went back to the rehearsal.
Winton actually looks back on that story with fondness, but suffice to say, he didn't last long at Juilliard. He dropped out after a year, and almost at once, he hit the big time. Picture the scene, a glitzy music venue in Tokyo. It's 1982 and the legendary drummer and bandleader Art Blakey is on tour with his celebrated ensemble, the Jazz Messengers. Winton, in tight flares, aviators and an afro, has just started a trumpet solo. And you can see Art Blakey at the back of the shot looking first to Winton and then out to the audience as if to say, yeah, he's good. As for Winton, he was already being called Boy Wonder. When did you realize that you wanted to leave Juilliard?
When I had the chance to play with Art Blakey in the Jazz Messengers. So you mainly play funk gigs and then you start to try to learn how to play jazz. Not that many people were playing it. And then he gave me the opportunity to play on top of that hot swing heat and the depth of his feeling and to see his passion for the music. And he treated me like I was family, and I treated him like that.
Dr. Billy Taylor is here to talk about Winton Marsalis, a young trumpet player I frankly never heard of. How did you hear about him?
Well, a friend of mine, Art Blakey, who is one of the grand masters of jazz, told me about this new trumpet player. I said, well, hey, let me check this 18-year-old out. He was fabulous.
And it was after you left Art Blakey's band that you ended up forming this band with your brother. What was it like to be playing with him? And also, how did your dad react?
Yeah, my daddy was always supportive of playing. He told me to drop out of school to play with Art Blakey. He was like, man, your school is going to be there. Art Blakey, that's the school. You need to go learn how to play. And me and my brother, we had grown up playing together. So it was great to have a group with my brother and to be able to take New Orleans concepts that we had heard our father do and play them in the style that we played them.
Did it feel like you were back in your bedroom? That's teenagers.
It didn't feel quite like that. It didn't quite feel like that.
It felt a bit cooler.
It was a lot more freedom.
A lot more freedom.
At the age of 21, Wynton Marsalis has the peer acceptance and critical acclaim of which grand careers are made.
Welcome to Wynton Marsalis Monster Music Class.
Hello, oh monsters!
Oh, yes, Mr. Marsalis?
Yes, oh master of music.
Today we have a very, very important lesson to learn. We're going to learn how to give Elmo an A.
How to give Elmo an A?
Elmo's going to get the letter A! Yay!
And from there, just looking through your list of achievements, it's pretty mind-boggling. I mean, I'm just going to list them as there's absolutely no way we have time to go through them all. But you got your first Grammy in 1983 for Best Jazz Instrumental Soloist. You also got a Grammy for playing Haydn's Trumpet Concerto with the National Philharmonic. You then became the only artist in any genre to win consecutive Grammys across 5 years. You were then appointed as the Artistic Director of Jazz at the Lincoln Center, which you still run today. And in 1997, you became the first jazz musician to win the Pulitzer Prize. So this I would like to talk about. It was for this composition, it was called Blood on the Fields, which follows the journey of a man and a woman from slavery to freedom. When you were composing that, how much of yourself and of your own history did you pour into it?
Well, I put a lot of my own history into it. You know, my great uncle was born in 1883. My family comes directly from that lineage. I mean, I knew about it. I'm from New Orleans, which was a big place for trading slaves. We used to have a museum called the Cabildo that had all the slave chains and everything. And I went on a tour of the Cabildo when I was 5 or 6 years old, and they gave us cartoons, a cartoon book about the life of Frederick Douglass. And I was always fascinated with slavery, hearing the old people talk about it. And members of my mother's family grew up on a plantation. My grandfather's people, they had a history and a tradition of sharecropping in Mississippi. So yeah, it was always on my mind, of something I thought about. I could still see the impact of slavery on the life that I live. And then because of my father, all the reading of all the kind of black nationalist books and literature. And for Blood on the Fields, I learned a lot of slave music and the modes. Of course, I knew a lot of the spirituals even by that time from growing up in that tradition. Saturday or Sunday, there would be these recitals that people would always make fun of older people, generally ladies, singing with a real wobbly vibrato. Soon I will be done. Me and my brother would go out, we'd just be laughing. So all of that material I was really familiar with, I had grown up with. So I wanted to tell this story of what freedom is, and it's all in the trying. It's the attempt is what makes you free. You could be free in your mind. So I wrote the piece based on that.
So when you were composing this, was it something that you'd have conversations with your dad about?
Yeah, I always talk with my daddy about all kind of stuff. So yeah. And a lot of what I was doing always, I was trying to impress him and wanted him to know what I was doing. I was being serious. So, yeah, I would talk with him. A lot of times I was teasing him because he was very serious. So I would joke around with him a lot.
Like, what would you say?
I have a stupid nickname I call myself. I would call myself by my nickname. That would make him laugh.
What was your nickname?
It's too stupid. It's too stupid. I can't say it.
What is it?
In the band, they were calling me Skane. They were calling me Skane. So I would call myself the Squazine. I said, man, look at this stuff the Squazine came up with. And I just stopped playing. And, you know, I really would be joking and clowning. He knew how, he just say, man, you crazy. You out your mind. He laugh and go, man, you sick. Man, you sick, man. You, something is wrong with you. But, you know, I always make the woman character is always superior to the man character. Whenever I write my music, and I would always say, look, man, this is you and mama. The woman knows everything, and the man is just standing there waiting to be told what to do. So I'd read him like lines, and I would tell him this. It was more like always in the context of joking or teasing or messing with him.
It was such an ambitious piece. How were you feeling the first time it was performed?
Well, I was real nervous because I had never written for a big band, and when we first started rehearsing, it sounded like absolute noise. And it was things I didn't know. So we were all sitting in there. A lot of the musicians were even young. The ones that were younger than me, I had met them in high school when they were 12, 13, 14. And they were looking at it, and we were all like, man, can this stuff actually be this sad? And then, you know, just like a Thursday, we had 5 days of rehearsal, which was unheard of. But we got to that fourth day. That was like the first time it started to actually sound like music. And then we started to realize, okay, this, we'd play it like this, or do this, or do that other thing. And I started to just get it together. We walked out of the hall that first night. None of us knew. And I had a friend of mine who was teasing and messing with me, and he was laughing. He's a gentleman who could imbibe quite a lot of alcohol. So he was in rare form that night. He had imbibed a couple of bottles of some of Kentucky's finest. And he would say, we gonna see now about it, we gonna see. You know, just laughing and, you know, we gonna see if you're a fake or not. It's just like a joke. And then, you know, we played it, it was pretty good.
Freedom is no simple thing, but all you need to know. Freedom's in the trying, just walk on through the door.
Still some things I needed to correct, but it was much better than I thought it would be.
Yeah. And I mean, that obviously played out when you were 35 and you were awarded with the Pulitzer Prize for that piece of work. What did that moment mean to you?
You know, for me, I didn't really know about what that was. Like, I always think about all the great jazz musicians, they didn't win awards. So I'm grateful to receive any award. If you cook a meal for me in your home, that is an award to me. If you bring your son or your daughter to see me and I give them a trumpet lesson and you thank me and shake my hand, that's an award. Some of the awards, like, you know, the Grammys and stuff like that, there's more popularity. But with the Pulitzer Prize, I knew they had scores and had looked at it. You know, being the first jazz musicians, I was honored by it. But I feel like other jazz musicians should have had it. So my father's like that. He's not really an award person. And I remember when I won my first Grammy, I was 22 years old. And my father and mother came out to Los Angeles. And my father's not, it never really been in a kind of pop environment. That's just not his thing. So I was in the hotel room getting ready to go out to a party, and I'm clowning and joking. And my father's kind of looking at me, and he goes, man, you know, that was the Grammys. Yeah, man, the Grammys. We out in L.A., man. I got the Grammy. You know, I'm just over celebrating. And he looked at me and goes, you don't think this means you can play, do you? I started laughing. I said, man, come on. I'm not into all that, man. I know I got to learn how to play. So, you know, that was his whole thing. You know, he called it cheap populism. Cheap populism, bro. Cheap populism.
So why do you think he played?
He was curious about the music, and he could play because he could hear and he could play.
Because you said in the past that playing jazz is like revealing a secret and communicating something about yourself. What do you think, when he played, he was revealing?
Well, his thing was just the warmth of his touch, because in person, he wasn't a person who was overly warm. He wasn't going to be hugging on you and crying and being over-emotive. I mean, I never saw that come out of him. But in his playing, it was always like a really beautiful touch. Very warm and loving. So I think that's the thing that he revealed the most. And also his intellectual interest in some of the music he wrote, which also for black people of his time, that was frowned upon. You have an Afro-American person had something sophisticated or complex. They were always accused of wanting to rise up out of the smoky basement or keep it simple, son, because you're like a step from the plantation. And my father had a lot of complexity to his personality that he could express in music.
Marsalis got his love of music from his father, Ellis. Now he's paying him back with an album of his father's favorite songs played by Winton's favorite jazz pianist.
I'm really proud of doing this album because I finally had a chance to do a recording with my father. I had to wait all of these years to learn how to play these songs, you know, because he used to always tell me when I was growing up, son, you got to learn how to play.
So who, Dad, when you record together, who carries whom?
Well, in jazz, it's not so much who carries whom. It wouldn't work that way. See, jazz is a very democratic process, and everybody has to carry their own weight.
This is your chance to say, I've carried him all these years, and I've done it again on the... But not so, huh?
Well, not really.
Well, he did all the work on it. He had to write out all the changes. I just said, what you think about this song? Hey, that's cool.
Wynton and Ellis would work together often, recording albums and even performing on stage with Wynton's brothers. And you told me about some of the early musical memories you have of your father. When was the last time you played with him?
When we played in Chautauqua, maybe in August. He was supposed to play CJ and Blues with the band, but he played Take the A-Train. He wanted to play on some chord changes. He didn't want to play the blues. He said, no, man, play on changes. Yeah, he played a great solo, too. He was killing. He has Parkinson's, and he's struggling with his hands, and he's having trouble moving around, but he played. That was a great solo.
When did you find out that he was sick with coronavirus?
Well, we didn't know what it was, so he was diagnosed like 2 or 3 days before he passed away.
And I mean, for you, I can't imagine what that must be like in a period when there's lockdown and there's social distancing. Where were you when it happened?
I was in New York. He went to the hospital on a Saturday. He got his diagnosis on a Monday. On the Thursday, I was joking with him about it and be careful and such, 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 such. But he said, a lot of people are losing their loved ones. And if you lose somebody, it's not any more significant than anybody else. He was never a person into the whole kind of emotional exploitation of his emotion. And he died in the same way. He was very cool about it. He just, okay. He said, are you breathing all right? His oxygen was being raised. He was like, yeah, I'm okay. And yeah, it's hard. Everybody grieves in their own way, and they feel it in different ways and at different times. And it's all so particular and specific. But I would just like to say for my father, he embraced everybody's loss is the same, but that it's what we have to do if we're alive. You know, we can deal with death as a fact of life, that they go hand in hand. And that's what he would say philosophically. And that's also how he embraced it when it came his turn.
Your dad does sound like a man who was full of lessons, that he would always be passing on these lessons. What do you think is the most important thing that he ever taught you?
I think the single most important thing that he ever taught me was to liberate yourself, to be you. Like when I was graduating from high school, I had made good grades in school. So all of my teachers were saying, don't waste your mind on being a musician. And my mother, everybody was like, man, don't go into music. You're going to end up struggling like your daddy did. You know, this is your chance out here. So I asked my father, man, what you think I should do? Should I? And then someone was saying, have math to fall back on, or take a law, just learn some other thing to fall back on in case you don't make it in music. And my daddy looked at me and said, look, man, I only got one piece of advice for you. Don't have nothing to fall back on. So that's he was always full of that kind of stuff.
When your mother died, you and your brothers, you led this big funeral parade through the streets of New Orleans. Do you hope to be able to do the same for your dad? And if you do, what do you think you'll play?
I do. I mean, we'll play the traditional music. But my dad was not a big one for that kind of stuff either, though. We'll do it, but it won't be because he wanted us to do it. We'll do it just because so many musicians love him, and he taught so many musicians.
At the beginning of May, Wynton was able to perform a virtual parade. Musicians recorded themselves from their homes, including his brother Jason, who was on drums. It's called Memorial for Us, honouring people who've passed away, including Ellis. And you've also said that he'd just play for one person. Is that something that you do now?
Well, I play for a lot of people because I became known and I got publicity, but I would play for one person. And when there are nights that there are not a lot of people in the audience, a lot of us in the band have parents who are jazz musicians. We laugh when we get on the bandstand and we say, there's a real gig tonight, because that's how we grew up seeing our parents play for not that many people, just to keep the music alive.
Jazz man Wynton Marsalis. He's also doing lockdown shows from his home in New York, and his band has really mastered linking up on conference calls, so do check that out. And Wynton's dad slipping him those Louis Armstrong recordings really did come full circle, as Wynton is also the president of the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation. I'm Emily Webb. I hope we've converted you. Thanks for listening.